This is Roland Chidiac Connects, a podcast about motivation and inspiration. Ever wonder what drives people to do what they do? Join me as I connect with a variety of people who have great stories to tell about what inspires them, ignites their passions, and leads them to make a difference in their work and the people around them. Welcome to Roland Chidiac Connects, a podcast where we talk about motivation and inspiration. And today is episode number 27. And I am pleased to say that I get to chat with Derek Rodenizer, who Derek and I have tried a number of times to connect, and it's just not worked. But today's the day. So, Derek, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited. Today is the day. It's great to make it happen.
I know it's so, I don't know about you, but when I get to connect with someone that I've been wanting to talk to, it's a great feeling. I get this rush because, you know, it's cool. It's like someone else has taken the time to talk. And so it's like, it's personal time, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's also like, we've been talking back and forth via Twitter, direct messages for a while now. So it's like, I kind of know you, even though we've never had a chance to talk live here. So it's exciting.
Cool. So tell us what you do in education.
So I'm the director of academics at an independent school, which is, you know, a bit of a different title, but it's sort of similar to a principal type role in that I get to deal with the students and teachers and the curriculum of the school. So I get to really just immerse myself entirely in the academic side of the school, and that's what I do. So I run my own podcast as well, Rodenizer EduThoughts, and I was one of the ways we connected is I was trying to reach out to other podcasters and try to figure out what everybody else is up to. And you were actually the one who turned me on to this recording device we're using right now. And I'm learning all sorts of stuff from other people, and really excited to connect and have a chance to talk with you.
That's awesome. I did want to talk about your podcast, so I'm glad you brought it up. But before we go there, okay, so are you the principal of the school, or is there an actual principal of the school?
Yeah, so the way that this school has organized its sort of division of tasks is that there are two of us. So I'm the director of academics, and there's a head of school. And the head of school runs the business side of things. So it's independent school, so all the sort of business stuff, the facilities management, marketing, all that stuff goes through her. And then I get to just focus on the kids and the teachers.
Okay, so I get it now.
It's the best of both worlds. I get to really focus into the academic piece, which is my, my passion and what I really love to do. And I don't have to worry about the things that surround it because it is an independent school, so it is a business. But at the same time, there's another educator at the high management level that I can also bounce ideas off of. So it really works out well.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, so you get to deal with simply the academics and not all the logistical parts that go with a public school principal's job.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's sort of a true academic piece. It's quite nice. I'm enjoying it. This is new for me. I've moved into this role 3 months ago now. So getting things sorted out and getting to know the community and the members of the school. It's JK to 8, figuring all the intricacies, and it's going really well. I just built a Lego wall in my office a month ago. It's really neat.
Very cool. So you've got kids coming in there and working with it, or is it simply for you?
Oh, this Lego wall, let me tell you, this is so great. So I got on this kick a while ago, this idea of learning spaces, right? So I'm really into learning spaces and thinking of classrooms as learning spaces and not just a place to put tables and chairs. And I've been involved with that pretty heavily. And then sort of it hit me like a ton of bricks when I got this new job that I don't think of my own office that way. But if you break down what happens in an office, right, like in a, like the principal's office, right, like I have conversations with students that had problems in class. I have success conversations. I have all sorts of different learning things, learning extensions outside of the classroom that happen in my office. But I don't think about what the place actually looks like. So I spent a lot of time when I started this new job thinking about how that would look and what I would do. And I made a bunch of changes. How I organized my office, thought of it that way. And then my latest thing was this Lego wall. And what I've been using it for is when you come into the principal's office, right, or in my case, the academic director's office, you it can be an intimidating place, right? And maybe you've misbehaved, maybe things have happened, and like to actually have a constructive conversation when your emotions are so charged, it's pretty tough. So this has been a nice little decompressor. It's like the day I've told this story a bunch of times now, probably. The day that I finished building my wall, I got a phone call, and we had a student who was just not listening to the teacher. He was out in the hallway. He was, you know, jacket over his head, not listening. And so normally I would approach that child, crouch down, talk to them, and, you know, try to make a connection. And eventually we go back to my office and we'd talk and we'd figure it out. Today I was able to walk by and say, all right, I have a Lego wall. You want to come build on it? And bam, he basically ran to my office. And, you know, we put the egg timer on so that they're not there all day. And he did it for 3 minutes. And then we had a really great conversation. And so that's been sort of the main use of the tool. But I've done a bunch of stuff with it. And it's been a real changer for me, not just the actual tool, but just the mentality of thinking about your office as a space, another learning space in the building.
That's very cool. There's nothing more exciting for educators than being able to reach a kid where they're at and be able to kind of engage them that way on their own terms. So that's really neat. I'm glad you shared that story. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you did before you were at this school?
So I've been in independent education for a while now. I worked with a school that predominantly had students with learning disabilities, ADHD, dyslexia for 8 years, and then I was at another school for another 3, and those were both VP roles, so that was the main focus there. So, you know, the traditional sort of VP role of a school, managing the discipline arm of things, and working with teachers that way. So this is my first sort of principal position.
So has all your work been in independent schools?
Yeah, it has been. It was an interesting transition for me. It was almost it was completely by accident, but it ended up being great. I did my training in New Zealand, so Teachers College in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. The way they do it there is it's a full year. It's a full 12 months, and it's January to January. So I finished in January, came back to Canada, and was looking for a job, and was just waiting for the Ontario College teachers to come through, giving me my number. And that was taking a while. So while that was happening, I started looking at independent schools, because they can hire you as a teacher or supply teacher without that number. And I got into one, and that path sort of opened up. And what I didn't sort of expect is the freedom that I can have within that space was bigger than I expected. So I had a chance to do some things that you might not have the chance to in a public school. Like I was able to. One of my favorite stories, I had a student ask me once, and I've taught grade 8 for a long time. A student asked me once how to grow pickles. And so I was like, okay, well, we have to have a garden, and we have to grow cucumbers and pickle them. Mm-hmm. And so we just did, right? Like I just walked to the back of the school and we did. And it went from there, and the garden got bigger, and I had a lot of freedom, and I was able to do a lot of things with that garden. And we ended up getting these reclaimed cedar posts that we used to surround this garden and make like a raised bed. And we used these railway spikes to hold it together. And then a colleague of mine from a public school down the road saw it and liked it and tried to recreate that at their school. And they got immediately shut down because a railway spike was used to hold together. And even though this thing wasn't showing and wasn't out and could never cause a problem, the board sort of said, nope, like this is a hazard, can't do it. And they weren't able to build. So like that red tape piece didn't exist in my world, which I appreciated. So it's been allowing me to do a bunch of different things. And then sort of secondarily, because I've been in independent schools, I've been naturally isolated a bit. So I'm not in a school board and I don't have that same wealth of colleagues. And that's allowed me to become a pretty heavily connected teacher, I think, by necessity. Like, mm-hmm. I needed Twitter. Like, when I discovered it, it was such a breath of air for me, because I lived in and worked in an environment that was pretty insular. So to get that chance to sort of get out and really see what's out there, is I latched onto it pretty hard. And it's one of the reasons that I sort of dove heavily into Twitter and why I've been pushing with my podcast and just trying to make sure that I get out there, is because it makes a lot of sense for my profession.
Yeah, that's cool that Twitter for you is a tool that, like you said, like it's a necessity for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, I think it's important for all teachers. I think, you know, your PLN is going to explode. Like right now, it's just your building and then maybe, you know, other teachers in your board and that sort of thing and your district. But once you go to Twitter, it becomes massive. For me, it was so minuscule because it really was just my building and whoever else I was able to make connections through, you know, sort of human face-to-face connections through on my own. So it was so important that I grow it. And Twitter was this great tool to do that. And now it's something that I really hold on to and I really advocate and I believe it's really important, but I'm not sure I would have latched onto it quite so hard, if it wasn't for the case that I was in. I mean, like, it's frustrating at first, right?
Like, for sure.
I've tried to connect some to Twitter and I have connected a bunch, but most have that same frustration that I had of like, people are telling me it's great and they tell me I can ask questions and I'll get answers and it's this great PLN, but it isn't until you have followers, right? For the first couple months, you're asking questions to no one and obviously no one's answering. So it takes a while to like build that organic, sort of thing around you so that it is a professional learning network. So it can be frustrating at the start, but I worked through that and, felt like it's been bearing fruit for years.
Mm-hmm. It's so true that at first it can be very frustrating. It's not great because you're right. You don't really know who to connect with. You don't have people following you to ask questions. So I know that I've done a few, like Twitter workshops in my district for teachers. And it's really awesome because as I spend more time talking to people like you and getting a feel for what's out there, it's really, made me aware of the importance of hashtags and the importance of having, you know, short lists of people who are very open to communicating with people that they don't know so that you can begin to build a capacity around it and a foundation. So I know, because you're right, like I forget sometimes where I started and how I started. And it was really slow and it was a matter of just connecting with people slowly over time. And I think the social part really helped me. Actually talking to people on purpose and going out of my comfort zone has allowed me to connect with people more like with depth instead of breadth. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, absolutely.
People like yourself, like you and I have had lots of Twitter interaction, direct messages, you know, public tweets, like we've been doing it and we're not kind of worried about it. We just do it. We ask questions or we talk about whatever or share resources. So that's a good reminder. What you said, you know, I was reflecting on what you were saying as you were saying it. And it's so true that when you start, they hear people like us talk about how awesome it is. But for them, it's like, you know, I've got three followers, one of them I don't know, and two of them who are sitting in the same room as me.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, how does this thing work? So you're right. People always ask me, you know, how'd you get all your followers? It's like, just, it took time. And, you know, I participate in chats and I cold call people all the time. Like I'll see something interesting and I will respond to a tweet, not knowing the people who are part of the tweet, and just kind of put myself in there and, you know, just start talking and asking people what's up and to tell me more about whatever it is they're talking about or to refer me to a resource that will help me out. And just, it starts like that and it keeps rolling.
Well, I think that's a confidence thing too, is like, I get that question as well, and I answer it as to where I am now. Like today, I have no problem cold calling someone. I have no problem jumping into conversations and not worrying about it. I know the Twitter language. I don't think about it anymore. Like I don't think about handles and hashtags and things like that because I know that language. But if you pull back to, I don't know, whatever it was, 4 or 5 years ago when I started, I probably had I was probably hesitant on those things. Now, personally, I'm pretty comfortable throwing myself at things that, it's one of my strengths. I have lots of weaknesses, but that's one of my strengths. But if that's not your strength, that's fine, right? But how do we figure out how to get around that? And hashtags and Twitter chats have always been my go-to. But last week, I was talking with Tom Whitby on my podcast, which, by the way, was very exciting for me because he was the first person I ever followed on Twitter. Yeah, it was really neat. And he was saying that, yeah, Twitter chats are great, totally use Twitter chats. But his biggest advice was stealing people's lists. So go on to an established Twitter user's profile, and they'll have lists probably of and find their, you know, top educator list or whatever and follow them. And I thought that was a sort of neat way to build a capacity and sort of at very minimum, maybe you're not engaging with those people, but at least they're engaging with you, right? They're filling your Twitter feed. So your Twitter feed will be filled with all of these sort of top educators to at least give you a place to start and to get a foothold into conversing with them, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. I never thought of that. But that's why, you know, you talk to people and you hear perspectives. And so now you've added to my repertoire of, you know, what I can tell people and actually what I can do too, because I'm always learning. Like, I'm never satisfied. I want to keep following people. I want to keep engaging in conversations depending on my interests or what's going on at work. So thanks for that. I appreciate that.
No problem.
Okay, so you're located in Ottawa, right?
Yes, I am.
And have you always been in Ottawa?
Yeah, as far as an educator, yeah. I was a military brat growing up, so I was all over the world. But yes, I've been in Ottawa for a long time and got some pretty solid roots here.
So is that the last place that you were based on, like, moving around in the military?
Yeah, it's a place where if you're in the military world, there's always a posting in Ottawa, right? At some point. And so that's where my dad stopped, and that's where we were, and ended up sticking around. So yeah, this has been home for me for a while, and it's always in my home as a teacher.
Were you guys living on base?
Yeah, I mean, there was, I was born in Bath, England, so I was in England for a while, and in Halifax, and, you know, various places.
Okay, I ask because I'm from Ottawa, and I grew up right by Uplands Air Base, so...
Okay, no, I never lived on base in Ottawa, no.
Okay, I'm very familiar with Uplands, lots of good times there.
Okay.
Really funny story, I ended up doing one of my practice teaching stints was at the Catholic school on the base, which was really cool. I had never had that experience, and I had only met students in high school who went to that elementary school.
Okay.
And they were, as you say, military brats. Like, they had traveled all over the place, and I guess when they got to Ottawa, that's where they went to school. So it was really kind of cool. So hearing you talk about that reminds me of my childhood. It's kind of nice.
That's great.
To take a tour down that lane. Tell me about your podcast. I want to hear a little bit more about it.
Yeah. So sort of the lead back into Twitter, it's been really good, but I felt like it was really surface. And I had someone explain to me that Twitter is like a great knowledge trap, right? There's all this knowledge, information, and ideas flowing by, and you can pull the ones you like, and then you need to do something with it. And so the podcast has developed into what I do with those ideas and those thoughts and those concepts that I like. So I, you know, use Twitter to make connections and meet people like yourself. And then having this podcast has been a great opportunity to then develop those ideas. So I have, my university background is in philosophy. I'm kind of into, big ideas and sort of big concepts and paradigms. And so that's kind of been my focus, is unpacking these philosophies and these ideas. And I started a blog a while ago to terrible success. It was absolutely brutal. I could not sit down to write a blog to save my life. I think I did 2 in a year. And while I understand exactly where people are coming from when they talk about blogs being great and an opportunity to reflect and to put your ideas out there in the world, I think it's an excellent philosophy. I just couldn't get myself into it. So I beat my head against the wall for that for a while. And then I sort of realized, well, we're differentiating for kids. So why can't I differentiate for myself? Can't I do something else? Can there be a way that I can do this that's more conducive to me? And talking is something that I have ease in. I don't prepare when I'm going to talk to someone on my podcast. I don't organize my thoughts. I don't spend a bunch of time worrying about it after an editing process. I just talk and off it goes and it's fine. And so that's kind of how the podcast started, and it ended up being, for me, this fantastic professional development. I could not believe it. The conversations I've got to have because of the podcast that I otherwise wouldn't have had have been great. So there's I run two different streams of my podcast. So there's the full episodes, which are just sort of 40-minute conversations, give or take, with educators. And they're really open and they're really general. And we just sort of talk about whatever educational philosophies you want. And then another one I run, same podcast, just another variety. I call them Edu Slams, are 5 minutes. And it's just a snippet of a learning journey. So that's just the straight reflection, the blog. So I did one about my Lego wall, for example, and about my first big failure in education and things like that. And just showing the clips of the parts of my academic journey that I want to reflect on. So it's like my blog. It's been great. I've been really enjoying the podcast thing and so glad that I'm doing it.
Yeah, there's something about it. It's just so, like, I don't even really know how to explain it. There's just something about it that, well, for me, I've always been interested in, like, the whole radio thing. So being able to talk to somebody in this way, like you're on the telephone, is pretty cool. I've not really delved into your podcast too much, but I need to. I'm going to. I feel like, I don't know about you, but I just feel like there's so much going on, and it's like no matter what I do, I just feel like I'm on like a cliff and I'm holding on for dear life at everything I'm doing, which is really wonky because I don't think I'm doing that much. But anyway, it's just a feeling I have. But there's a list of podcasts that I need to start listening to, and yours is one of them. So
well, I
don't
realize
think
the world that's out there. Like I mean, I listened to a few different podcasts and I started mine, and then I started. Then I realized, like everything else, right? Then you realize what kind of niche there is. I mean, there are so many fantastic education podcasts out there. Like, I don't listen to the radio anymore. I get some of my best PD on the drive to work.
Yeah, see, my drive is 10 minutes, so it's not where I used to work half an hour away, and that was, I loved the reflection time that I had on my drive. Now I love being closer to home, but I don't have that time. Actually, I listen to podcasts and I watch them too on YouTube, which is kind of an oxymoron, but I do it at night when I'm you know, starting to get ready for bed and I'm just kind of taking it down a notch.
Okay,
I use that time. Yeah, I use that time to listen in and check things out. So I'm going to add you on to that list and I'm going to keep going with that. I would love to ask you what inspired you to become a teacher or to get into education?
Oh boy, there's a question for you, right? I was one of those kids that was always sort of involved in educating pretty early. And then, like, you know, doing the coaching thing was a big piece of my childhood. So I did a lot of coaching, which was a bunch of different sports, sort of all the way through university, but never really thought about teaching. I mean, I even taught swimming lessons, but teaching never came up. And like I say, I did a degree in history and philosophy, and finished fourth year university. And like many folks, I had no idea what I wanted to do, and spent some time traveling around. I took a year just traveling back and forth across Canada. I worked on a salmon farm for a while, and worked on a barkentine in Halifax for a while, and a bunch of different things. And it was just kind of one of those lightning bolt moments where I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And then it sort of became painfully obvious to me. And I've actually reflected with my mom, who was a gym teacher for her whole career. And she described it as waiting for me to figure it out. She's like, she always knew that I was going to be a teacher, that it made a lot of sense. But for some reason, I didn't. So I'm not exactly sure what the impetus was, but it's definitely something that, looking back, it sort of made a lot of sense for me. And am I ever glad I jumped in? I mean, I really appreciate, especially where education is going now. I really love this idea of the sage on the stage sort of no longer being the thing. That was the one thing that made me a little bit uncomfortable when I was in the classroom. And I love that education is moving towards this idea of we're all learning together and with this growth mindset, and that everyone's sort of trying to figure things out as we go. Something that I really appreciated and glad that it's really glad that it's going in that direction. So yeah, happened by accident. Like I say, I trained in New Zealand. One of the reasons I went to New Zealand is so I could learn how to surf. But really glad that I went and trained to do teaching there, and it's been a good ride. So I taught grade 8 for a while, and then went to be a VP, and now doing the administrator thing.
What generally motivates you and inspires you daily?
I think it's definitely the continual learning piece, whether it's observing that in kids, in teachers, or in myself, and figuring out sort of how to get there. I really like that puzzle. Like I love that I can come into the workday and I have an idea of what's going to happen, but I don't really know what's going to happen. And there'll be a bunch of obstacles laid out, and we can figure out how to get across it and how to go forward, but we're still going down our main goal and our main path. I've lately really been enjoying the world of like professional development and educating teachers. And I've been working with Ottawa University and with a couple different classes there and getting you to talk to, you know, student teachers and as they're coming forward. So figuring out sort of that best answer to that ongoing riddle of how are students going to learn is that piece that motivates me. And the thing that I've been dealing with the most lately, personally, I was thinking about this, is this failure piece. So I don't know where your thoughts are on this. So it's become almost, it feels like it's almost become trendy to say that we should embrace failure and value failure and understand how it's important to fail. And I believe that, I don't believe that it's easy, but I believe that it's important. And then I got in this conversation the other day and I realized that we don't have the same definition of failure. So can I throw it on you, and just out of curiosity, how would you define failure?
How would I define failure?
Yeah.
I would define it as not being successful at what you're doing the way that you would define success.
Okay. So I was thinking it in like a really binary way. So if you have a task, there are two options. Either that task is successful or that task is failure. Those were sort of my thoughts, and whether they be micro or macro, right? Like, I'm going to go have lunch at 1 o'clock. I didn't. So I failed. Right?
Yeah.
So that was my sort of thought. But the more people I talk to, the more I realize that in a lot of people's words, failure is loaded, right? That example is not a failure. That was a mistake. That's what someone sent me yesterday because I used that example. That's not a failure. That's a mistake. A failure is when, you know, you do something catastrophic that is a real problem and affects other people around you. I was like, oh, well, so I can understand why somebody might have that fear if that's the vision they're looking at, right? And like, if I can break it down so that small everyday failures don't bother me, then is it easier for me to understand and accept bigger failures and how that was built up and how that came to place? Anyway, it's something that I've been wondering about.
Well, you know what? If I could jump in, when you talk about failure, I'm glad you brought it up because you're right. It does seem pretty trendy these days to talk about failure and that it's all good and this and that and the other thing, right? I'm proud to say that before all of this became popular with respect to, you know, social media and the people we follow and just like the way that society's moving in that direction right now, my philosophy on education has always been and you know what? I knew nothing when I became a teacher. I still know nothing. And it's one of the things that keeps me moving in the right direction, I think. But for me, my belief, my philosophy has always been that the one place where people can fail without, where there should be no repercussion or issue, should be school. It's the only place where, if you think about it, people come to school every day. And people are here to learn. So they're constantly making mistakes. They're constantly moving down a path of trying to excel or achieve at something.
Well, you're in the lab, right? You're in the lab. This is where you should be making the mistakes because you're not out there. You're in here, like where it's supposed to be safe.
But you know, my experience has been that people don't agree with what my perspective. People are like, no, there's rules. There's ways of getting to where you need to go and yada, yada, yada. And in my brain... failure has always been like the Google model where, you know, people go to work at Google and get paid to try new things, and it's more about the process rather than the final product. And I don't know, I think about all the talk about failure now, and it's like I've always considered school the place where it should be the safest place to go and fail all the time. Like every day, all the time. I mean, of course, there's successes. There's a lot of achievement. But in order to get there, people have to fail. Like you can't, I only know two people in my lifetime who have been able, like 90% of the time, to try something and get it right away. No, and they're just, that's just who they are. That's the way that they were built. And to this day, I'm still like, I just, when I'm in their presence, it's always like I'm just wide open, ready to hear what they have to say, ready to see what they have to do. Because in my lifetime, those couple of people have been able to just, anything they touch turns to gold. And I have no idea how they do it. They tell me they have no idea how they do it. But aside from those two people, I don't know anybody that can just touch something and make it work the first time around.
Yeah, well, and the other thing too that is that, then you're saying that because you know what the end result needs to be, right? So if this person is trying X to perform Y and they're succeeding, you already know what Y is before they've done it, right? So that's how you're judging their success. So one of the issues I think with this idea of being afraid of fear is that we're also creating a very uncreative path. Because if we're creating an environment where I'm expecting you to succeed, it also means I know the outcome. But if I create an environment where I'm not so worried about failure, I'm not so worried about the outcome, then I can get all sorts of different outcomes, right? I can create all sort of creative different results. Had a really interesting conversation with this guy, worth looking up, called Andrew Pelling. And he's a biohacker here at Ottawa U. And his big thing is that he was able to make human ears out of apples.
Oh.
It's so neat. Like, it's mind-blowing. If I can give you – I gave you the Cole's Notes versions here, so you should look it up. It's a great video. But the basic idea is you can take a piece of apple. So he took a piece of apple. He figured that out, that I can take the apple and I can bust open all the cells and I can pull out the apple DNA and I can put in human DNA. And then the human DNA will grow in the structure of the little piece of apple, which you can kind of probably get your head wrapped around. Okay, that's pretty cool. And then what he did was that his wife makes violins, and so he asked her to model a ear out of an apple, and then do that same process out of that model ear, and like, bam, human ear. So, you know, the guy that they created this human ear out of an apple for like the cost of an apple. And it's completely mind-blowing. It's this huge innovation in science. You know, he's a TED fellow because of it, and you know, labs from all over the world are throwing money at him to do stuff. But what's really cool is they didn't set out to do that at all. You know, he has this lab, and their philosophy is there's not just scientists in the lab. So they've got artists, they've got engineers, they've got musicians, got all these different people in the lab, and then they try things. So apparently the impetus of this particular invention was they were goofing around one day and someone had watched this ridiculous movie where a plant came to life and they wanted to see if they could make a living plant. And they were goofing around and then they ended up figuring out this technique to put human cell DNA into this apple cell. So like no one sat down and said, we want to learn a way to grow a human ear. Mm-hmm. But they got there. And what a huge success, right? With tons of failures during the way. But the fact that there was no defined end in this particular case, and I would argue in many cases, allowed for a really interesting, creative, useful solution that wouldn't have happened if we felt that need to have a linear definition of what we're trying to achieve.
That is so cool. And it helps bring me to my final question for you in the podcast. If you're ready for this?
Born ready. Here we go.
Okay, awesome. So when I hear you talk about that, like I'm motivated to go watch that video now. I'm totally interested. I wanna wrap my head around that more, right? I wanna get the details, the juicy details. So that what you just talked about has given me what I call a personal project for this evening. I'm gonna squeeze that in somewhere. At the same time, I'm gonna be signing up to get your podcast on my mobile devices. But anyway, what would you say to someone who comes to you and tells you that they're not motivated, they're not inspired, and they're looking to you to kind of get some advice on what what they could do or what they might want to try in order to kind of feel the love again for the work that they're doing. What would you say to them?
Teachers?
Let's keep it, educator?
Okay, let's keep it in that world.
Sure.
So probably more than 9 times out of 10, the reason that we want to come into education, the thing that kind of keeps us going and is like at the pit of our stomachs, is that we want to see kids succeed. We want to see them learn. We want to see, you know, results and movement forward. And like, you ask a teacher about what one of the best teaching moments is, I mean, it's almost always going to be about this child that had this difficult path and it was really challenging for them. And then there was this great success that you were able to help them with. Right. So advice I often give to people, and this might sound really foolish, but advice I often give is go out into the hallway and go give 5 kids a high five. Mm-hmm. And it's really foolish, but it'll change their day. And it's this weird thing where high fives are this universal language. Everyone knows they're excited, they're positive, they're good. You don't have to explain them. It's okay if they're kind of weird and strange. And you'll go back into your office or your classroom and feel, you'll feel that connection. You will, I promise. And I think we get caught up in the big steps, right? We get caught up in just like Andrew Pelling and inventing the ear out of the apple. Like, wow, I could never do that. But that's the big step. What about all the little steps in between? It's those little steps that are going to make the difference. So if you can think about those little individual wins, what can I do today to get a win? I think you're going to start seeing those results, right? Like,
yeah,
you're on episode 27 of the podcast. That's probably daunting to somebody who wants to give it a try. But if like somebody wants to give it a try, just go for it. Just do one. You don't have to do 27. Just do one. And if that's the end, that's fine. But you sat down with someone, you had a conversation, you recorded it, you know, well done. Just don't worry about all the way in the end. What's that one thing you want to do today?
Mm-hmm. Very good. Hey, thanks for sharing that.
No problem. Thanks for asking.
No problem. It was a real pleasure to get to talk to you today. And I look forward to continuing our conversations via Twitter. And, you know, it'd be great to meet face-to-face one day. Maybe that could happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for making the time. I'm glad that it worked out today. I got the message this morning, and it just so happened it worked out quite well, and really appreciate it. It's been a lovely talking to you. I'm sure it will happen again.
Awesome. Have a good one.
Cheers.